I, Neil M. Gorsuch, do solemnly swear
that I will administer justice without respect to persons.
It's a beautiful spring morning in Washington, and Justice Anthony Kennedy is at the White House for the ceremonial swearing-in of Justice Neil Gorsuch.
This is Ruth Marcus. She's a columnist for The Washington Post.
And he is the one who's doing the swearing-in because Neil Gorsuch was a clerk for Anthony Kennedy.
So help me God.
Congratulations.
But at the time that Justice Kennedy is doing the swearing-in, it's not just Neil Gorsuch that's on people's minds. What's on people's minds is whether Justice Kennedy himself can be induced, coaxed, cajoled into stepping down anytime soon.
Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy may be ready to step down after nearly 30 years on the bench.
The swing voter on the high court is said to be considering retirement.
Part of his legacy is the newest justice, Neil Gorsuch.
Chuck Grassley of Iowa told the paper, "I would expect a resignation this summer."
This is something that President Trump and the lawyers in the Trump administration just desperately, desperately want, because naming Supreme Court justices is a legacy thing for presidents. And at this point in the Trump administration, things were really quite chaotic and not doing very well.
The president blasting reports that his administration is in chaos, calling it, in his words, a fine-tuned machine.
Is this a fine-tuned machine or an administration careening out of control?
What we've seen from this administration is a lot of chaos and confusion.
But naming Neil Gorsuch was a really big triumph and accomplishment for President Trump, so he wanted the chance to do it again. So Justice Kennedy gets word to the president that he'd like to speak with him privately. And the message that he has for the president in this conversation is this. You, President Trump, have done something very unusual, which is you've not only written down short lists of who your Supreme Court potential nominees are, but you have made those public. You have promised the people who elected you that you will choose only from those lists. Now, that's well and good, but there's somebody important missing from your list, and that person is a former clerk of mine, a judge on the D.C. Circuit named Brett Kavanaugh.
Judge Kavanaugh was a former clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy, a long history of serving Republicans.
Close friend and advisor as a White House lawyer and staff secretary.
He worked with Ken Starr, who investigated Bill Clinton.
Former loyal aide to President George W. Bush.
It is no accident that Brett Kavanaugh is not on President Trump's list. He was not on the first list that President Trump produced when he was a candidate. He was not on the second list, and that was for two reasons. One is that Brett Kavanaugh, who was a judge on the D.C. Circuit at the time, had a Bush problem. He was closely identified with George W. Bush, for whom he had worked, and President Trump didn't want any Bushies. But when Justice Kennedy talked, President Trump listened, and lo and behold, within several months, President Trump put out list number three, and one of the names on that list, and the main reason for that list, was Judge Brett Kavanaugh. It was immediately after that that President Trump started saying to his aides, "Hey, who is this guy Brett Kavanaugh? Why didn't you guys tell me that he went to Yale Law School? I'm really interested that he worked for Ken Starr and went up against the Clintons. Do you think he'd be a strong, good Trump justice?" That really got his attention.
Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
A woman says the president's U.S. Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, assaulted her when she and Kavanaugh were both in high school.
And her allegations are coming to light now because she recently wrote a letter to her congresswoman in California. That letter was then passed on to the top Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dianne Feinstein.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In her new book, Ruth Marcus traces the path that got Kavanaugh onto the Supreme Court. And really, the story began a long time before Trump or Kavanaugh were on the scene. The book is about how a group of legal and political conservatives have been plotting for decades to get a majority on the high court. And that would have been interesting enough. But this is also about the frankly sensational machinations that went into the nomination. Today in the program, Ruth Marcus is joining us. Her book is called Supreme Ambition: Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. You say that this is a book that I think you put it this way. You've been preparing to write your whole life. Let's start there. When did you start thinking about this? I guess you would have been looking for a big subject to write. I mean, when did you settle on this one?
So great question. I have been wanting to write a book for several years, but I was not finding the topic that I thought would really give me the energy to wake up and work around the clock on a book. But I have been writing in various capacities at the Washington Post about the judicial nominations wars for longer than I care to admit, stretching back actually to the defeat of Judge Bork in 1987. This was the kind of opening salvo and still a kind of raw open wound for conservatives, where the leading originalist jurist at a moment that looked very much like the moment when Justice Kennedy retired, which is to say a very closely split court, a swing justice leaving, and President Reagan nominated Judge Bork. Judge Bork was defeated because he was viewed as too extreme, too far outside the mainstream. And the person who replaced Judge Bork was none other than Justice Anthony Kennedy. So I covered the Bork nomination. Then I covered the Clarence Thomas nomination, which included the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings. And so amazingly enough, we found in the Kavanaugh nomination, and by the way, along the way, I covered the Starr investigation and the Clinton impeachment. So I got to know and actually found in the many, many thousands of pages that were released an email about my invitation to Brett Kavanaugh to go to a White House correspondence dinner back in 2001 during the Bush administration. So I got to know young Brett Kavanaugh when he was when I was a younger reporter and he was an even younger lawyer for Ken Starr. So then fast forward to the Kavanaugh nomination, which took the ideological stakes of the Bork nomination, the gender politics of the Thomas hearings, ramp it up in the new tribal and hothouse atmosphere of the Trump administration. And it just became clear to me a few days before Justice Kavanaugh was confirmed that this was the book that I had been waiting to write.
Mm. One of the things you've said is that the reason that a lot of people have been puzzling over, how is it that Brett Kavanaugh managed to get through the confirmation process? And you say it summed up in some ways in the title of the book, Supreme Ambition, that it's about this greater sense of ambition. And there are two parts to that. There's Brett Kavanaugh's own personal story, his own personal ambition, which we'll talk about. But then there's the second part, and that is the effort of these movement conservatives, the Federalist Society, to reshape the federal judiciary. That's part of the ambition part of the title, I think, as well.
That's absolutely true. There are two parts to the ambition. Brett Kavanaugh clearly had been talking to friends about this from very, very early on in his legal career and had been maneuvering to get there. His colleagues on the Federal Appeals Court used to talk about certain decisions that he made. They called it auditioning for the Supreme Court job. But in some ways, the more important and interesting aspect of the story is precisely what you say, that his nomination and his ultimate confirmation is the reflection and the achievement of the three-decade-long ambition of conservatives to do what eluded them for so long. They were frustrated by and devastated, really, by Bork's defeat, and they declared that that was never going to happen again. They were frustrated when, after that, Justice Kennedy turned out to be so squishy on some issues from their point of view, though he's a pretty conservative justice. They were really unhappy when David Souter, who was named by George H.W. Bush was not the home run for conservatives that was promised. And so they vowed that never again were they going to allow a justice to be defeated like Bork was, and never again were they going to squander an opportunity as they did with Souter. And so when Brett Kavanaugh ran into trouble and this supreme ambition was potentially being interfered with, Brett Kavanaugh had become too big to fail, and the conservative legal movement and Republicans in the Senate and elsewhere were not going to allow him to be defeated.
It's interesting how much of a kind of personal connection you had to the various chapters of this story, your own life intersecting with key elements in it. And one of them, we should say, which gets us to really the sort of beginnings of the Federalist Society. You're there at Yale, really, it seems like in the beginning when this group of conservatives start getting together and talking about reshaping the judiciary.
Well, I was up the road a little bit at Harvard, actually.
Oh, sorry. I'm so sorry.
But I do remember that moment. It was a weekend in the summer of – in 1982 when at this moment in law schools, you have to understand that conservatives were a very beleaguered minority. The notion of originalism and interpreting the Constitution on the basis of what the original intention of the framers was a kind of wacky, outlier, somewhat ridiculed idea. And so you felt a little bit kind of sorry for this beleaguered band of conservatives that gathered in New Haven one weekend. And who could have imagined? In fact, they never imagined in their wildest dreams, because I talked to a number of the people who were there on that weekend, that the Federalist Society would from that moment turn itself into this incredible powerhouse, this legal employment agency for conservative lawyers. At the time, Brett Kavanaugh became a sort of not all that energetic or involved member of the Federalist Society. Some years later, about 5-6 years later, when he was a student at Yale Law School, but he was one of the seedlings that grew in the Federalist Society, and some of them sprouted into justices.
Ruth, how important to Trump's election was the prospect of getting a conservative on the high court? You mentioned in the book that social conservative and evangelical voters were suspicious of Trump, but the idea of getting a conservative majority on the high court, that seemed to make all the difference to the way they were thinking about him?
I think it did make all the difference, and it really doesn't matter what I think, but Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, thinks it made all the difference as well. If Justice Scalia had not died suddenly at a ranch in Texas in February of 2016, it is entirely arguable that Donald Trump would not have been elected president. But that vacancy really focused the mind of evangelical and social conservative Republican voters on the court. And then President Trump did this thing that was so unusual. It was actually unprecedented, and it was so effective, which is he came up with this idea of the list. And it was aimed not at figuring out who the potentially best justices were out there, but it was aimed explicitly at making sure that the kind of voters who had real questions and understandable questions in their minds about Donald Trump — this is a guy who was married 3 times, this is a guy who's a former Democrat and had given to Democrat, this is a guy who had been pro-choice — he wanted to send a message to them: I will fill the courts, I promise to fill the courts with judges and justices that you can rely on, and I'm making this pledge by giving you these names. If it hadn't been for that list, I think it's very possible that those voters would not have been satisfied by Trump and would not have turned out for him.
You tell the story of the meeting of in the conference room of a law firm in of Don McGahn's law firm, where they have this meeting to talk about the importance of judges. And you talk about how Leonard Leo of the Federalist Society, he stays behind, and he actually has a list, 6 people. But I guess Brett Kavanaugh wasn't on that list at that time.
Brett Kavanaugh was not on that list, and it's really important to understand what a surprise that is for a few reasons. At this point, Brett Kavanaugh had been a judge on the D.C. Circuit, which is often and probably correctly described as the second most important court in the country, for close to a dozen years. He's a very well-respected Republican judge. He had the right pedigree, was young enough to be an attractive nominee, had worked closely with Leonard Leo on judicial selection when he was a lawyer in the Bush White House counsel's office. So the fact that Leonard Leo, when he gave that list to the president, did not have Brett Kavanaugh's name on it was really quite remarkable. There was a reason for that, which is that Brett Kavanaugh had been assigned to hear a case about the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act. And he did not vote to strike that law down. He voted instead to kind of kick the can down the road and maybe think about whether it was a tax and maybe they'd get to it eventually. And that did not stand him in good stead with the Leonard Leos of the world. And they had a few other questions about whether he might be too squishy. And as I mentioned, that was fine with President Trump, because when Don McGahn during the campaign raised Brett Kavanaugh's name with President Trump as somebody he might mention as a potential jurist, potential justice, President Trump was having none of that because of the Bush connection.
You tell the story of Brett Kavanaugh's life, his upbringing, and how that plays into the idea of his sense of ambition. It's interesting to read about John Roberts, Chief Justice John Roberts' early life. He had a very similar kind of upbringing to Kavanaugh's. But there's one difference, I think, that you write about. Most people who knew Roberts would not have been surprised to see him become the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. That just seemed to be where he was headed. But I guess people didn't seem to think the same thing about Brett Kavanaugh. I mean, he seemed bright. He seemed like he was going somewhere. But it seems like they didn't think, oh, he's a Supreme Court justice in the making.
I think it's fair to say that nobody in Brett Kavanaugh's college class at Yale and nobody in Brett Kavanaugh's law school class at Yale thought of him as a future Supreme Court justice in their midst. And he is very smart, and he has a very good resume at Yale College and Yale Law School. But unlike, for example, Chief Justice Roberts, who was an academic superstar from the very beginning of his college career and throughout, Brett Kavanaugh was a different kind of creature. He basically left no real academic mark at Yale College. He graduated cum laude, which is with honors, but half his class graduated cum laude. And one little story that may explain young Brett Kavanaugh to your listeners is when he applies to Yale College, there are two questions, essay questions, that Yale asks applicants to write about. Brett Kavanaugh's essays for answers to both of these questions were about basketball. Right. He was a sports guy. Yeah. He was a sports guy. He wasn't either an intellectual or actually particularly politically partisan. Kavanaugh was not – he was kind of viewed as a vaguely conservative guy, but not a kind of rip-roaring conservative, hairy-chested conservative Republican type.
And you also mentioned that – he was one of the chapter headings is "No Rebel, No Cause." He was a man who, as you say in the book, never had the urge to rebel or even to roam very far from the familiar.
He lives about 3 miles from the house he grew up in, and he is still friends with his very close friends, with those people he grew up going to parochial school and to church with. And you saw these people come out in force and en masse for him when he became, you know, under attack with the allegations from Christine Blasey Ford.
Ruth Marcus is a columnist for The Washington Post. Her new book is Supreme Ambition: Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
What happens when a Mormon a Muslim and a rabbi walk into a bar? Join us at the Preach Podcast live show to find out. Special guests include comedian Stacey Harkey from JK Studios, co-founders of the Emerald Project, and a millennial rabbi. Plus live music and limited edition Preach swag. Preach Podcast Live is January 30th at the State Room in Salt Lake City. Tickets and info at preachpod.org/live.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Ruth Marcus of The Washington Post is joining us. Her new book is the inside story of how Brett Kavanaugh, a young law student more interested in basketball than legal theories, made it onto the Supreme Court. It's about how he survived allegations of sexual assault and how his confirmation marked the culmination of a decades-long project by conservatives to reshape the federal judiciary. The book is called Supreme Ambition. At what point did Justice Kennedy decide he could retire with Donald Trump as president? There's something you write about. Kennedy's son told Trump's counselor, Kellyanne Conway, that, I think this is the quote, no one was happier about the election of Donald Trump than his father. What did he mean by that?
Justice Kennedy is understood as a swing justice, but it's also very important to understand that he is and was a lifelong Republican. Grew up in Sacramento, part of the Republican community there, was not going to retire and allow his seat to be filled by a Democratic president. So even though Justice Kennedy is not a Trump Republican, I think he was quite relieved when a Republican president was elected instead of Hillary Clinton, a Democratic president. And so that scene that I describe actually takes place at a fancy dinner here in Washington called the Alfalfa Club. It's the weekend after the inauguration. And Gregory Kennedy, who's one of Justice Kennedy's sons, not the one who worked for Deutsche Bank, but the one who went to Stanford Law School and was actually president of the Federalist Society at Stanford Law School, comes up to Kellyanne Conway, delivers this news about how pleased his father was with the election results. And Kellyanne Conway says to him, that happiness matters. That's good to know that happiness matters. And she went back and she reported it to the president and to others at the White House. And they had already gotten soundings from Trump's, from Kennedy's sons and from others close to Justice Kennedy that he was interested in retiring. They were convinced early on in the administration that they were going to have two vacancies, the Scalia seat that was filled by Gorsuch, and that Kennedy would also retire, that they'd be able to fill two vacancies in their first 6 months. That didn't happen. Some people thought that I have a scene in the book where Don McGahn comes barreling into Steve Bannon's office after the president is tweeting about the Ninth Circuit and so-called judges and saying it's screwing everything up for us. He's never going to retire now about Justice Kennedy. And in fact, though they were really hoping and expecting that Justice Kennedy was going to retire after the end of the term in 2017, they had to wait till 2018 for that to occur.
There are a lot of really important characters in this story. Leonard Leo, we mentioned. Mitch McConnell, we mentioned. You write about that. But also Don McGahn. We need to say something about the role because he's really critical to this story.
He is absolutely critical to this story. He is not your ordinary White House counsel. For one thing, most White House counsels are either very esteemed, well-regarded lawyers or extremely close to the president that they work for. Don McGahn is neither. He is a kind of a middling election lawyer. He had been a commissioner on the Federal Election Commission. He gets introduced to Trump. He is not, as we all know, Donald Trump loves good credentials. Don McGahn went to Widener Law School, which is a not very well-regarded law school. And though he's a partner at a nice Washington firm, he's got this really big chip on his shoulder about all these fancy Harvard and Yale guys, which is kind of interesting because he really did become Brett Kavanaugh's biggest advocate and used that Yale credential to promote Brett Kavanaugh. But Don McGahn is close to Mitch McConnell, and the two of them together recognized that getting judges done was going to be First of all, Mitch McConnell had managed to slow things down in the Senate so much that there were a number of judicial vacancies when Donald Trump was elected, and that they could really concentrate the energy of the Senate, actually prioritize judges over executive branch nominations, and get this done. And though President Trump never liked Don McGahn very much to begin with, there was this one thing that Don McGahn was really good at from President Trump's point of view, and that was getting his judges done.
How much of a role did Brett Kavanaugh himself play in the lobbying to get on the list and to become nominated? Because when you report in the book about these moments when the Kavanaugh team felt demoralized and didn't think that Kavanaugh was going to get the nomination, it made me wonder, did that include Kavanaugh himself? Was he part of these meetings? Was he part of these conversations, sharing in the disappointment, sharing in the strategy?
Yeah, he was. He was particularly hands-on in orchestrating and quarterbacking and observing this. First of all, getting on the list. Second of all, making sure that once he was on the list that he was in a good position to be selected. He knew that President Trump was going to call. Every president makes phone calls to figure out who he should nominate, but President Trump was going to call really random people like Steve Wynn, the casino magnate, who is the was the finance chair for the RNC, and President Trump reached out to him, and Kavanaugh made sure that there was going to be somebody close to Steve Wynn who was going to say nice things about him. And so they finish up the term, and there is no announcement from the bench that Kennedy is going to retire. And so Judge Kavanaugh lets his wife know, okay, it looks like there's not going to be a retirement, so we can go ahead and put down the deposit on the beach house in Rehoboth, we're going to go to for the summer. And then a few hours later, whoops, Justice Kennedy is retiring after all, and Judge Kavanaugh is spending his summer making sure he's in the position to be first nominated and then confirmed.
It's interesting, and this seems like one of the kind of important insights in the book, is conservatives, as you say, had learned from the costly errors in the past of presidents, you know, miscalculating the conservative ideology of their picks. But one thing you mention in the book is that for, you know, the real movement insiders in the Federalist Society and others, maybe not the conservative pundits or talk show hosts, but the real movement insiders seem to be, these days anyway, less interested in the social issues, although, you know, abortion is important, of course, but they were really interested in dismantling decades of regulation. And you say the project sort of shifted from those issues to what Steve Bannon would call the deconstruction of the administrative state. Like, this was a really important thing for them.
Really important, and an area in which I think we're going to see the impact of Justice Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court. The Republican coalition and even the Republican and conservative legal coalition has obviously different pieces to it. For people like Leonard Leo, it includes the entire project. He is very, very committed to making sure that Roe is overturned, and very committed to issues of religious freedom and religious liberty, which Justice Kavanaugh is interested in as well. But there has been increasingly, and this has been fueled in part by some of the donors to the Federalist Society, which are both business interests and conservative legal interests that are from the business perspective, including the Koch brothers and others, to make sure that there is this change in the atmosphere with which we think about regulation. There's a case called Chevron, and it basically says that where an agency is issuing a regulation, that courts should defer to the agency's interpretation of the regulation. And so it basically means that if the EPA says we're going to have this regulation on clean air, that's it. You could actually imagine it in a world where it's a conservative administration like this one, that would be good for conservatives. But overall, this idea of deferring to administrative agencies is viewed as something that has helped further regulation and therefore helped liberals and hurt business. And that has become a really, really important piece of the conservative legal agenda.
Well, you write about how Kavanaugh manages to clinch the nomination from Donald Trump. I wanted to ask you about September 13th. The Judiciary Committee, the Senate, is scheduled to take up the nomination. And the chair of the committee, or the ranking member of the committee, Dianne Feinstein, she approaches the chair, the Republican of the committee, Chuck Grassley, and as you tell it in the book, asks if she can have a word. And she asks him basically to step into a bathroom.
So let me set the scene for you. The day before, first of all, it looks as if Brett Kavanaugh is well on his way to confirmation. But the day before, some of these rumors had been brewing for a bit, but a story starts to break. It's very unclear what it is, but it's about a letter that somebody has sent to Senator Feinstein. That somebody, of course, turns out to be Christine Blasey Ford, about an incident that it's not clear at the time, but it turns out to be the allegation that Christine Blasey Ford was making about what happened between her and Brett Kavanaugh in a summer in Bethesda so many years ago. And there's an earlier scene off the Senate floor in a very ornate room called the President's Room, where the Democratic senators on the Judiciary Committee are saying to Senator Feinstein, "What is this letter? We need to see it." They see it and they say, "Oh, my Lord, you got to get this to the FBI." Senator Feinstein says, "Okay, I'll give it to them tomorrow." And they say almost in unison, "No, Dianne, you're going to give it to them today." So they cannot believe that they are basically reliving another 11th hour situation like Anita Hill and Clarence Thomas. So the next morning, the Senate Judiciary Committee is scheduled to have their first round of taking up the Kavanaugh nomination. It's going to be put off for a week as a matter of course. And it's after that session that they're in the ante room, which is a kind of not particularly attractive room behind the sort of wood paneled room behind the regular Judiciary Committee hearing room. Dianne Feinstein goes into this bathroom. The bathroom has like this wall-mounted sink and wall-mounted toilet. I say it looks like the faculty bathroom in a public middle school. And and it's tiny. It's about 4 by 6. And she motions in Senator Grassley, the chairman of the committee, and says, "Chuck, could I have a word with you?" Asks Chuck Grassley's chief counsel to go get her chief counsel. And so the four of them are in this bathroom with the door closed, and it is the first time in what the Grassley folks ended up calling the bathroom summit that Chuck Grassley gets the first inkling that there is a woman, he doesn't get her name at the time, who has made this allegation against Brett Kavanaugh. And that was my favorite bathroom summit.
We need to talk about Christine Blasey Ford. And one thing, I guess I didn't realize this or know this at all, that she, aside from her job as a professor of psychology, she's also a passionate surfer. And there's an important theme in that avocation here that you write about, the idea, the importance of sticking to the idea of paddling in. Tell that part of the story, because that's, I think, important to all of this.
So Justice Kennedy announces his retirement at the end of June, and Christine Blasey Ford, who's on an academic schedule and is an absolutely passionate surfer, spends most of her summer days with her children down further to the south surfing just as much as she can. And she loves surfing, and as she is hearing about first the Kennedy retirement and then the notion that Brett Kavanaugh, a name she knows very well and a memory that is quite searing in her telling, is on the short list. She keeps thinking, what am I going to do with this? What am I going to do with this? And she decides to come forward first to her local congresswoman, Anna Eshoo, and then eventually over time in a letter to Senator Feinstein, mm-hmm. her local senator or state senator and the ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. And she's debating with herself whether to come forward, whether she has the – she believes it's her civic duty to let them know, but she is a very private person. And she is telling her lawyers, who are not surfers like I am not a surfer, that the worst thing, the most kind of humiliating thing you can do as a surfer is to get out to the wave and then decide it's too much for you and to have to go through the humiliation of paddling in. And she doesn't want to have to paddle in, but she makes this decision at the end of August that coming forward, going public with her allegation is not going to change anything, that it's just going to be so terrible and disruptive. She's not worried about herself as much as she is worried about her family, including her family back east. And so she decides to do this thing that she's just filled with almost self-loathing about, which is to paddle in. And then, of course, the decision about whether to come forward or not is taken away from her because the story of her letter leaks.
You mention – one thing you mentioned, though not until the end of the book, is that you've known Brett Kavanaugh for some 25 years. And you mention how you've always liked him, that he was always helpful to you. He was open. He was gracious and friendly. And you say when he was nominated that you didn't really see, at least at first, a substantive basis for opposing him. But then Christine Blasey Ford comes along. And I'm wondering, how does that change – you're thinking about all of this? Because one of the things that you write about in the book, and this is interesting, is that you say anyone who professes absolute certainty about what took place in that story is not dealing fairly with the imperfect state of evidence. So talk about how you're thinking about this and how you're balancing all of this.
Right. So in my day job, I am, among other things, a columnist for The Washington Post, and I'm a left of center, but in my assessment, pretty much slightly left of center columnist, and I'm somebody who cares a lot about the court. So Brett Kavanaugh would not be my choice if somebody made me president tomorrow for a Supreme Court nominee. Elena Kagan would be more of my choice for a Supreme Court nominee, or Justice Ginsburg, or Justice Sotomayor, or Justice Breyer. But I do believe that elections have consequences, and I do believe there are really significant differences among the various people that President Trump had on his list. And so I was surprised, and I write about this at the very end of the book, I was surprised when Judge Kavanaugh was not on the president's original lists. And I was actually kind of relieved both when he made it to President Trump's list and, in fact, when President Trump chose him, because I thought he was a much more mainstream, run-of-the-mill Republican type of president choice than some of the other possibilities were. So I sort of figured when Judge Kavanaugh was nominated that he would be confirmed and that we as an editorial board at The Washington Post would be inclined to support him. And I was quite concerned about some of the procedural issues relating to his nomination, like whether there were adequate documents from his time in the Bush White House that were being turned over. But those didn't go to the merits of his nomination. When the Christine Blasey Ford story came out, well, first of all, I was having Anita Hill PTSD. I couldn't believe we were reliving something. It was different, but it was the same in many ways. And it was a very serious set of allegations that I thought we needed to grapple with. And there were – and for me, it was very much like the Anita Hill hearings. And I was very struck, and I write about this in the book, by something that Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia said then, which is the benefit of the doubt when there's when you're not precisely, absolutely 100% confident what happened, the benefit of the doubt should go to the court. Nobody has an absolute entitlement to a seat on the Supreme Court. And in this situation, just to be really clear, I believed Christine Blasey Ford's story. I thought that she had no motive that I could determine to oppose Brett Kavanaugh. So I believed her.
You also believe Kavanaugh is telling the truth as he believes it. That's one thing
you
also said.
Some people think this is hopelessly naive on my part, but I just cannot find anybody to whom Brett Kavanaugh has expressed the slightest doubt that he believes he didn't do this. I think the most likely explanation is it was just another drunken night and a bunch of dumb things he did when he was a high school student.
Yeah.
For me, the final straw really was his performance that day that is seared in all of our memories, that afternoon before the Judiciary Committee, because I thought the intemperate nature of his remarks, the angry nature of his remarks, the partisan nature of his remarks really was disqualifying. And it made, in a way, for me, the decision to oppose confirming him a much easier one than it would have been if he had come in with a different temperament.
Yeah. You write, you don't have to meet the burden of proof, but you do have to meet the burden of persuasion.
That's what I thought that much of the way we talked about this at the time was not helpful. No nominee deserves the presumption of innocence. The presumption of innocence is absolutely essential element of due process in a criminal trial. This is not a criminal trial. At the same time, I thought it was unfair to the nominee and to the terrible harm that could befall him and his reputation and his family if he were being falsely accused, to think of this only as a job interview. It's not just a job interview. His life was being put on display. His reputation was being put on hold and at risk before and, you know, the entire country.
Well, back to an extraordinary moment behind the scenes that you report. And this is as Donald Trump is seeing Christine Blasey Ford speak at the hearing, testify at the hearing, and gets flustered, the question of whether or not he's going to stick with Brett Kavanaugh. And he makes a phone call or tries to make a phone call to Don McGahn. Tell this story, because McGahn doesn't take the president of the United States' call.
This is an unbelievable story. So this is September 27th. Christine Blasey Ford has testified. She has astonished everyone, including her own lawyers, who had not heard. Normally, a witness would practice something like this. You would go over it. You would figure out the delivery. She did not want to look rehearsed. Her lawyers were not convinced even the day before, even the morning of, that she was actually going to make it into the hearing room and be able to deliver this testimony. So she, unbeknownst to everybody, is one of the most powerful and effective witnesses of all time. And so after her testimony, the Republican senators are in their caucus lunch and they are just saying, he's sunk, he's dead, RIP Brett Kavanaugh. The president is calling friends and allies and saying, what do you think? What should I do? And he's trying desperately to reach his White House counsel, Don McGahn. Don McGahn is in the Senate with Brett Kavanaugh and Ashley Kavanaugh and the whole team. And Don McGahn is convinced that that the president is calling him to tell him to pull the Kavanaugh nomination. And he's not taking the president's phone call. And, you know, nobody doesn't take the president's phone call. Certainly nobody who is his White House counsel doesn't take the president's phone call. So finally, and it's not just once, it's repeated. Finally, a woman named Annie Donaldson, who is Don McGahn's deputy, reaches out to him and says, the president's trying to reach you. For goodness sakes, you need to take his call. And Don McGahn says to her, I don't talk to quitters. So this is actually one of my favorite stories of all time, because just a remarkable insight into how tough, actually, and acerbic Don McGahn is. And you know, I'm not sure that the president was calling to – people have insisted to me that he was not trying to get him to pull the nomination. But what an incredibly aggressive move on McGahn's part.
Yeah. So there's this question of whether all of this, the tumult of the confirmation process, whether that would make Brett Kavanaugh more conservative, which, as you point out, it seemed to be what happened to Clarence Thomas after his confirmation process. But you say there's also some reason to think that he may go the other way, that he may find a way to try to sort of ingratiate himself with liberals. Where do you think he's ended up? Where is Brett Kavanaugh these days in terms of what the Federalist Society hopes, that he'll be a reliable conservative?
Well, what we have right now is a court with five conservative justices, and nobody should mistake it for anything but. But there is a difference among these conservatives. So the least conservative of the conservative justices is the Chief Justice. Mm-hmm. And so where Brett Kavanaugh has situated himself on that small conservative spectrum is much closer to the Chief Justice. He has been a little bit more conservative than the Chief Justice in his first term, but not as conservative as Justice Gorsuch. This coming term at the court, which is could promises to be a remarkable term, we're going to have decisions on everything from abortions to guns to protection for gays and lesbians and transgender workers to religious freedom to the legality of the Dreamers to the president's ability to keep his financial records private. This term is going to tell us a lot more about Brett Kavanaugh, but I do think and the other justices, but I do think that while it's really clear that the impact of the Anita Hill hearings on Justice Thomas was to embitter him and to push him further to the right, I think Justice Kavanaugh, it's a little bit more up for grabs. Hmm. He wants to be he loved teaching at Harvard Law School. He wants to be well regarded by the legal establishment, which is still a very liberal legal establishment, notwithstanding the impact of the Federalist Society. He doesn't want to be persona non grata in that community. And so there is a way in which, not on the cases that matter most, on the cases that matter most, he will be a reliable conservative vote. But on some cases where things are a little bit more up for grabs or up in the air, he may do things that either disappoint conservatives or gratify liberals. So I think he's a different personality and less conservative and less embittered justice potentially than Justice Thomas turned out to be.
What about the institution of the Supreme Court? Where does all of this leave it? Because you mentioned how some of the sitting justices were appalled by Kavanaugh's behavior in the hearing, but you also say the court is pretty good at healing itself after things like this. What do you mean?
Sure. The court – well, the famous formulation about the court is that it's nine scorpions in a bottle, and so they sting each other. But the reality is that there is another way to think about it, and it's a way that Justice Sotomayor has talked about it, which is it's a family. These guys have life tenure. They are stuck with each other, for better or worse, for life, and they have to find ways to get along with each other, both because life would be miserable if they were just simply at each other's throats, but also because as a matter of strategy, you want to be able to lure somebody over to your side. So when you have to live with somebody and you're part of the institution with them and you've known him for a while and you've not seen behavior like that from him before, I mean, he didn't arrive at the court as a stranger to any of the justices. It's really – there's this kind of human capacity to forget what you saw and to try not to think about that unpleasantness. And I think we've seen that in the way the court has taken him in.
Ruth Marcus, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. It's been delightful.
Ruth Marcus is a columnist for The Washington Post. Her new book is Supreme Ambition, Brett Kavanaugh and the Conservative Takeover. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard, Ali Viarta, and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.